Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle Radio. Each week, the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in finance take you beyond the numbers and hype, right to the heart of the big issues of the day. Today for you, we have a special edition of the programme in which we're asking, how do you build better? On the 3rd of October, the UBS Sustainability and Impact Institute published a new white paper entitled Rethink, Rebuild, Reimagine: The Untapped Opportunity and Overlooked Risk in Buildings and Structures. Two of the paper's co-authors are here to explain what this process needs to look like, from how we rethink buildings to where rebuilding is appropriate to reimagining their structures so as to best balance urban growth and sustainability. Our panellists from the UBS Sustainability and Impact Institute will discuss how these processes start with putting the needs of everyday residents and communities on a par with bringing buildings into line with net zero targets. So, let's meet our guests today. William Nicol is ESG analyst at the UBS Sustainability and Impact Institute, as is his colleague, Richard Miles. It's a great pleasure to welcome William and Richard to the show. Well, Richard Miles, just to kick things off then, let's talk about, I guess, the changing nature and needs of buildings over time. And there are lots of factors acting on that space, aren't there? Including some of the big secular themes that we often cover on this programme. Talk to us a little bit about what that change over time looks like when it comes to buildings.
Sure. And I think what's interesting about buildings is that the what we need from them, you know, plus somewhere to work, somewhere to shelter, somewhere to sort of connect with other people. You know, those needs haven't fundamentally changed throughout time. But obviously our built environment, the way that our built environment meets those needs does change sort of, you know, fundamentally, right? So I'd say to look at a broad level, buildings are kind of about, they're a confluence of the tech that we have, our own priorities, and then structural factors like the needs of the economy. So in practice, you know, if we look back at like the first industrial revolution, we had various technological advances in industrial manufacturing and whatnot. And that created this sort of potential and an economic need for growth in populations around factories. But the massive growth that we saw, say, in London, wouldn't have been possible without other advances in food production, so you could feed all those workers that were moving from the field to the factory, and health and sanitation advances that mitigated outbreaks of disease. So yeah, if we look through history, cities never really grew much beyond a million people for that reason. But London added something like 5.2 million people in just 90 years in the 19th century. So the way that the cities and the built environment evolves is very much sort of a product of these big sort of secular forces. You know, another one might be the development of the car, which allows sort of urban sprawl and sort of the rise of the suburbs. Now, obviously, anticipating our future needs of decades in advance is not the easiest thing. But where we think is a good place to start is with sort of today's megatrends. So we look at four which we believe have kind of acute relevance for the built environment. First of those being urbanization, growing urban populations contrasting with declining rural ones, demographic change with many countries facing sort of aging populations and declining workforces, the fourth industrial revolution, which, you know, is going to sort of require sort of fewer in-person interactions and perhaps less demand for offices. And of course, you know, the big one, which is climate change. We need our buildings to decarbonize, and we also need them to be able to adapt to changing weather patterns. So the upshot of that is that all of these ongoing changes mean that a static building environment is not going to be able to accommodate our future needs. So we're very much thinking that the emphasis should be on building flexibility into designs, facilitating usage change, upgrades, extensions, refurbishments, so that adapting the building stock to future demands doesn't require demolishing and starting again with all the environmental and carbon costs that that entails.
Yeah, as Richard was saying, there's these four broad mega trends, right, that we think are shaping what future buildings could look like. And as we look forward, we think that by 2050, the total building floor around the world is going to increase by about 75%. What does that really mean? It's the equivalent of adding the surface area of Paris every week for the next 25 to 30 years. So we know there's going to be a lot more buildings, but we're not really sure what they're going to really look like. And the framework we have for the report is that buildings will generally always meet a certain set of fundamental needs, but how they meet those needs will change over time. And we think these four mega trends of urbanization, demographic change, fourth industrial revolution, and climate change are what is going to shape what buildings look like in the future.
So that's the backdrop to the white paper, if you like. Richard Miles, back to you. Tell us more about what you and the team were looking to document then with this piece of research.
So I think the key thing is that this is maybe one of the sort of slightly less sort of sexy aspects of the climate transition and the climate debate, but it's an incredibly important one. Buildings account for 40% roughly of our emissions globally, 28% of that coming from the sort of existing building stock, 9% from construction. So if we're going to have any chance of meeting our sort of Paris climate goals and 2050 net zero targets, we really need to find a way of getting those emissions down, and we need to do that in sort of rapid form. So in terms of the report, we wanted to sort of split that problem down into sort of three or four areas. The first of all, looking at our existing emissions, so how do we bring down that 28% number? And that's really where we sort of talk about this, the need for a retrofit revolution. We need to sort of go into existing buildings. We can't knock them all down. That would just be a terrible for increasing the emissions from construction. So we need to kind of try and insulate and retrofit and bring the energy efficiency of those buildings right up in order to sort of make them net zero ready. And then we look at building. We'll get into that, come into that a little bit further in due course. Need for innovation there. We have sort of a huge amount of emissions from things like concrete, cement, and sort of different building techniques that need to be sort of scaled and rolled out there. And then we look at sort of the reimagining aspect, which is that, you know, sometimes retrofitting isn't enough. We can't be too prescriptive about how we decide sort of we make the building environment sort of fit for purpose, because it's not just about climate. You know, people have to live in these buildings. And so you have to kind of balance climate concerns with the kind of social aspects. And so there we were looking at, right, when, you know, if maybe a building isn't fit for purpose in its current form, but perhaps there is a conversion opportunity here, or perhaps, you know, sometimes it is actually necessary to knock down and rebuild better. But, and also increasingly, and this is one, you know, really interesting, particularly in developed markets where we're seeing falling populations and sort of ongoing urbanisation, there are going to be times when we actually just want to decommission these buildings and rewild. Those are the sort of three sort of angles that we look at in this report. And then the final chapter is a sort of, you know, what can different stakeholders, what can governments do, what can finance do, what can banks like UBS do in order to sort of achieve the goals that we have.
Well, yeah, and we'll come back to the delivery of some of these ambitions in a moment. William, let me bring you in, though, here, because I guess one of the things that really struck me from the report is this idea that there is an attitudinal shift required to acknowledge that there is no fundamental, there's no inherent barrier to decarbonising most of those emissions that Richard's been talking about. And as with so many of these very profound questions, often it's the attitude maybe that needs to change first.
Yes, completely. I mean, we looked at some investment estimates as part of the report, and the overall kind of dollar cost, if you look at all the technologies that we have today to decarbonize existing buildings, works out about 11% of current investment in real estate. So the dollar cost is high, but it's not so high that it endangers basically decarbonizing our building stock today. And as Richard mentioned, we have a lot of the technologies that we need today to do that and bring emissions down, particularly on the operational emissions side. So emissions that buildings emit just through existing and running, through things like consuming energy and that kind of thing. There are some technologies that are still in the pipeline, and we don't expect them to emerge in the real estate market until the late 2020s to maybe the mid 2030s. And that's things like reducing emissions in the materials that are used to build buildings, so things like cement and steel that are very carbon intensive. But considering we have all the technologies today to reduce the vast amount of building emissions, so those operational emissions, it does imply that maybe there is more of an attitudinal issue today that is preventing decarbonisation.
Well, yeah, and alongside that, and I guess, an understandable but not acceptable short-termism from some of the stakeholders, there are also issues with things like inadequate data around this space, and also about the incentivization to make progress. Perhaps you can both talk a little bit about that, because you know, it's something we come back to when we talk about sustainable practices in a whole range of different disciplines. You know, we don't really know what the sort of acceptable green premiums are. We can't always necessarily agree on what the data points are. And therefore, it makes it much more difficult from a sort of regulatory and incentivization standpoint. Maybe you could both reflect on that problem a little bit for us.
Getting this right from an incentive standpoint is really, you know, a huge part of the whole ball game. And at the moment we have green premium, there's a lot of green premium research out there. A lot of people sort of trying to work out what the level of it is. Does it even exist? And I think intuitively we kind of know that as regulations are tightening and energy efficiency standards are rising, there is going to be a sort of, from a regulatory standpoint, there is going to be this pressure for, you know, green buildings to take precedence and for those values to go up. And plus, we're also seeing on the demand side, you know, people want to live in greener buildings because the bills are lower and they're just generally a better experience to be in those. However, the fact that there is so much research still going on does sort of show that there isn't really the level of confidence in the green building premium and the trajectory that it's going to be on to actually achieve the goals that we have. So I think what we would sort of suggest is that it's incredibly important to try and make sure that we increase confidence in that green building premium. So one of the difficulties with it, for example, is that you can't disentangling the green building aspects from other aspects of renovation and refurbishment is quite often quite difficult. And so there isn't necessarily the confidence among building owners that if they put a load of solar panels on their roof and insulate the fabric of the building, they're actually going to get rewarded for that in terms of their rental yields and capital values. And I think until we can kind of get to a point where that confidence is at a reasonable level, we're not actually going to be able to solve this area, and we're not going to be able to scale retrofits to the level that they need to be.
William, let me just bring you in though on that point. And I guess we're talking about regulation again. In the piece, you often talk about the carrots and sticks required. If we look at the role of governments here, we need to disincentivize short-termism. You know, it's plain that Richard's already spoken about that. But I guess there is this balance between, you know, penalising buildings and developments that are underperforming, but you need to balance that with positive incentivisation, the carrots, if you like, particularly if we're talking about trying to catalyse the level of private investment that's also required here.
Yeah, completely. And in the report, just to flag, it's not all a role of governments. In the report, we emphasise the need for a whole value chain approach, because the market failures that exist in the real estate market today require actions from stakeholders across the whole value chain. And there is an irreplaceable role for governments, but equally there's an irreplaceable role for like finance as well, for example, because of banks like UBS's cross value chain position and the fact that we plug in capital across the whole market landscape. So we're in quite a powerful position to help, I guess, correct those market failures that exist today. As you said, there's an important role for government to try and correct existing market failures today. And we dig into these a bit more in the report. But from our perspective, you can summarise these into three buckets. The first is information failure. And we see this particularly in carbon data, where there's not a lot of building owners disclosing the emissions of their buildings. And when they do, different methods are used which make the final sort of ton of CO2 emissions of even two similar buildings hard to compare sometimes. So it leads to people within the market speaking past each other and makes it very hard to have, I guess, like-for-like conversations about building sustainability. So that's one, information failure. Two was about positive externalities, which is one of the classic economic problems, right? And this can really be summarized as rewarding better buildings, which, as Richard was saying, was all around this green premium and how it's very difficult to untangle the green aspects of a building, so its energy efficiency, etc., from other things that feed into value, like location to transport and just the quality of the building overall. And generally, we don't see a consistently higher price for green buildings in every single market, while we see evidence emerging for, I guess, location-specific studies that can find a bit of a higher, I guess, capital value for some greener buildings, particularly in areas like London and New York, which some UBS workers looked at. We don't see it consistently. So the market generally needs to try and reward these better buildings to create the incentives to improve existing buildings. And finally, the last market failure that we look at is negative externalities, which can be summarized as penalizing non-green buildings or worse buildings. And this is because the impacts of these worse buildings on cities and the people that sit in the buildings isn't reflected in values. And a good example we look at, for example, is In West London, you have a lot of data centres that have been built, and they have very vast power demands on the local power grids, and that's led to houses not being able to be built in the area anymore because of the excess strain it places on the power grid. But the value of those buildings won't reflect those kind of broader externalities. And again, this feeds into the broader market failure of value not reflecting the negative impacts of buildings. Circling back to your point about governments, there's an important role for governments as well as finance and basically everyone in the value chain to help correct those three market failures, broadly to ensure that there's enough information in the market and that buildings' value reflect their sort of true impact on society.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And it's interesting to me in the summary towards the end of the piece, there's this quite kind of fundamental reminder that even with all of this climate consideration, we need to remember that buildings are primarily about people. And I think this is where it's really interesting for Monocle as well. We're super interested in what delivers quality of life in a holistic way in cities. And you've both spoken already about increasing urbanisation, which is continuing and at pace. And there is a risk, isn't there? Rich, perhaps I'll come back to you on this one, that if we focus too explicitly just on the environmental goals, we may overlook some social factors. And it's very important to still remember that buildings often need to be occupied, lived in, used, and we don't want to go too far the other way, because then we risk other things, early obsolescence, other broader sustainability goals. So we have to be holistic in our approach.
I think if we forget that these buildings are actually used by people to live and work, a good example is like if you're forcing people to keep sort of, you know, old buildings with low ceilings and no natural light and which are very unattractive to live in and work in. And you say, well, because of embodied carbon emission concerns, we're not going to let you knock that down and start again. Or where there are opportunities perhaps for, you know, big co-benefits, like for example, say one that we mentioned in the report is this development by a company called Stories, where they've got an existing homeless shelter of two stories and they want to knock it down and rebuild an 8-story homeless shelter with a 20-story apartment block. So there's a clear sort of social and local area benefit to that development. And if you were sort of so concerned about keeping buildings at all costs, then I think that you would miss out on some of those. And I think the second point here is that, you know, you want to make sure that you retain local support and at the aggregate level support for sort of sustainability goals. And if you're forcing people to live in buildings they don't want to live in, then not only are those buildings essentially going to fall into obsolescence before you would like them to, but you're also not going to bring people on board along with your sort of broader sustainability goals.
Yeah, and William, perhaps let's bring it back, because we've already touched on this idea of the power of the financial sector broadly, and of course UBS, such a consequential player specifically. Can we talk a bit more about the role of the financial sector? I know we've touched upon it, because it's developing fast, but it is still only nascent. And there's some interesting points, again, in the report. Green real estate bonds, for example, and mortgage-backed securities, only making up a pretty small proportion of conventional bond issuance at this stage, a new mortgage loan. So there is this cross-value chain proposition, which you mentioned earlier. Can you just tell us a bit more about what that actually looks like? You know, the sort of the nuts and bolts of how better finance can really be one of the key drivers of change in this area.
Finance has this cross-value chain position in most markets because it plugs capital in at different links in the chain, right? And there's different flavours of capital which it can use to meet different means and promote different kind of sustainability outcomes. And we divide finance's role in the report really into two broad buckets. One is better finance and then one is better value chain. So drilling into the first one, better finance, we see the role really in three areas. The first is just in growing and aligning sort of green investment products. So as you mentioned, things like green mortgages, because of this cross value chain position and the flow of capital into different areas of the value chain, how you design these products can help promote greener buildings and disincentivize non-green buildings. So that's a really important area, I think, for finance. The second is aligning information flows. And this relates back to that information failure that I noted earlier. And again, because of finance's cross value chain position, it can promote disclosure across the whole real estate market and ensure that those disclosures are very comparable, which is really important for real estate because the global market is made up of lots of really localized sub-markets with very different practices. So ensuring there's some kind of global consistency between them, I think, is a key point to ensure that as buildings decarbonize, it's in line with the trajectory towards the Paris Agreement. And then the final area of this sort of improving finance, better finance piece, it's about adjusting horizons and how finance, I guess, approaches valuations and really ensuring they try and reflect material transition risks where they're relevant, because we see these risks as potentially growing. For example, as regulations kick in, and in some markets you see kind of minimum energy performance ratings ratcheting up towards 2030, which could be a material transition risk for some buildings. And finally, the sort of better value chain area and role of finance is really around, I guess, ensuring that there are effective conversations going on throughout the value chain, and finance can facilitate these because of its cross-market position. And that involves things like connecting the dots between different stakeholders. So UBS, for example, has this quite innovative mortgage renovation calculator, which helps connect residential customers in Switzerland with the provider of a calculator so they can help size the potential cost of renovation. And that's quite key because I think everyday residential mortgage holders don't really chat to, the valuers of retrofit costs. So providing that tool just upfront helps to really help facilitate these conversations across the value chain. And then we've also got points about sharing best practices and forming private partnerships to really help capital find those green building opportunities where they're present, but they might not have access to capital today.
William, just perhaps a final thought. Obviously, there's this very pronounced focus on addressing the climate crisis. And looking through this prism of buildings and structures, there's maybe not so much of a focus on biodiversity itself. Can you talk to us a bit about how nature is integrated into the thinking here?
Yeah, of course. Nature tends to be the less focused on area when you're talking about sustainable building, and climate tends to dominate. And this is, I guess, maybe a factor of the fact that we see nature being squeezed out of cities over time. I mean, there's an interesting stat in the report about how when you get a 10% increase in the density of a city, you see a 3% fall in green canopy cover. And we think this is largely due to how urban areas are essentially a big competition for space, right? And the uses that can generate the highest value tend to win. But when you have things like nature, which doesn't generate any revenue or market value, they tend to get squeezed out because their opportunity cost, if you like, in the urban area is very high. This means that if you want more, I guess, bits of nature like green trees or parks in urban areas, you really need to go back to that carrots and sticks piece, because in markets, nature doesn't have a representation. So it's all about essentially incentivizing nature's inclusion through things like, for example, Malmo's urban greening factor, or I guess better incentives through planning to include nature from the outset in building design.
And that is William Nicol. And before that, Richard Miles, bringing us to the end of this special edition of The Bulletin with UBS here on Monocle Radio. Follow us at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can look out for more from and about the white paper from UBS from the 3rd of October. Head over to ubs.com/better-buildings. And there's even more to discover about the Institute, including some thoughts on how you can help drive sustainability at ubs.com/sustainability-impact-institute. I'm Tom Edwards. This is The Bulletin with UBS. Thanks for listening.